Session number 13582, reel number 2.
Mr. Tran, reel 2.
All right. Now, what we couldn't understand is, I repeat this, we were always told that communists and Stalin was the arch enemy of Germany. And here suddenly Hitler had made a pact with the communists. He had sent von Ribbentrop to see Molotov, and they had concocted this pact of non-aggression and mutual help. And then, of course, they joined the war and came into Poland from the east. What I couldn't understand is, when England declared war on Germany, Hitler was given an ultimatum to stop the war in Poland, get out, and if he didn't do that, England would be in a state of war. Now, when the Russians, of course, attacked, I would have thought the same thing should have applied again, that England probably should have said, well, we have got this pact with Poland, this non-aggression pact, there's the aggressor from the east. We are morally obliged to declare war on them, but they didn't. Have you ever thought about it, why that wasn't the case?
Quite a bit. But what happened to you after your period on the farms in East Prussia?
Well, we came back then because war had broken out in France. And I decided to stay with the working service. My 6 months had come to an end, and in the meantime they had sent me to a group, which is a division, little headquarters. A group was like a division in the army in Hagen. And I had come to the staff there as a Truppführer. And so I signed on. And in 1940 we went into France when Hitler started the war in France. And we built field aerodromes for the Luftwaffe with the help of French farmers who came and helped level the ground, etc., etc., and made it possible for the Luftwaffe to build airstrips. Now, my job and my superior, he was a Feldmaster Wesselmann, who was about the rank of an Oberleutnant, was to pay the French farmers for their work they had done. So we had hundreds and thousands of French francs to distribute. So that was my experience in France.
Where did you build these aerodromes?
In northern France.
Do you remember the names of any?
Peron, near Peron, yes, and just outside Mons. We had moved through Mons into France. Beauvais was another aerodrome in Beauvais. It really meant just a strip for the planes to start from and land on.
What was the name of the organization you were in?
Arbeitsdienst. The Reichsarbeitsdienst.
Part of the work service.
That is right. In fact, if I show you my army pass.
How did you get on with the French people in the summer of 1940?
Well, first of all, I must admit they were terribly frightened, dreadfully frightened, because they had left their homes, but then they were told to come back and they would be humanely treated. In fact, we were living in those days in private villas and in chateaus sometimes, and we were living quite well because all these houses were stocked with plenty of wine. People couldn't take that away. But there was an order that once they came back, we had to get out of the houses or live in the servants' quarters. Give it back to the people. And in Roa, I lived in a villa which belonged to Monsieur Lesage, who was the managing director of a big sugar factory. And I became very, very friendly with him, actually. We stayed there for about two or three months. And he had fought in the First World War, and in fact he had been a student in Germany. And he spoke quite good German. I had taught myself some French, and I had learned a little French on a course, but with him we could converse in German. In fact, he had studied at Tübingen in Germany. Now, I must say, we became more or less friends. Although his daughter-in-law, his son, was serving in the army, and he was taken prisoner and was in Germany. His daughter-in-law, she obviously didn't like us. But after a while, after I gave chocolates and sweets to the kids, and she warmed to us, you know, and very often gave her extra rations because things were very scarce in those days. She warmed to us.
What was his attitude to the occupation of France?
He probably didn't tell me the truth, but he always said it was terrible that this war had happened. I believe in his early days, he obviously must have been probably a Germophile, I don't know. Hence his perfect German. And he had to spend holidays in Germany, so he was rather disappointed with the whole thing. He thought it was awful that it had to come to this.
Was there any problem for you being in France in these days?
Well, we always had to go armed. Sometimes I used to serve as a dispatch rider, go from one camp or one aerodrome to another. And I was always told to take my Luger pistol.
Did you ever have to use it?
No.
Did you ever?
Matter of fact, I became rather friendly with the maid of Mr. Lesage, you see, and she invited me to her house. And this is something I'm not very proud of, because her husband was a prisoner of war. And because I helped her, she invited me to her house to cook for me, because I had provided the meat, you see, and one thing and another, so we finished up in bed in the end. But I still had my Luger pistol there. And of course I can still see her eyes, you know, when I took that thing off and put it there. What do you want that for, you know? Günther, what is that for? Well, it's orders. Because you never knew. Very often people were enticed into situations like that, and the Marquis came, opened the door, bah, 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 and there you are. Lots of people got shot and killed.
Many?
So no doubt. Well, quite a few, yes. They were ambushed.
Even in 40?
Less in 40, but later. But even then, there were some people, you know, you always find extremists. But I never came across anybody, no. But I must say, this time in Roa, I really lived like they say in Germany, Gott in Frankreich, like Gott in France.
But did you get anybody who showed you hostility?
Well, they didn't do it to my face. They probably did it behind my back, yes, probably. Although I must tell you, later on, when I was stationed at the battery at Wimereux, around us were two or three farms, and one of the sons of the nearest farm to us, he and I again, we became quite close friends. I was invited on several occasions to the farm to have a meal with them. And one of their ladies who worked there, she did all my washing. So we had quite an amicable relationship with these French people. In fact, two or three years ago, Marie and I, when we came back from Germany, we went to Wimmera, and I was looking for our old battery, but of course it's now a golf course. Everything has been flattened, but one or two of the bunkers, the heavy bunkers, they couldn't blow up. They just earthed, put the earth onto it, so you can still see at the edge of this golf course parts of the bunkers which belong to the very heavy coastal battery.
Now, in the summer of 1940, you were in the Reichsarbeitsdienst.
In Reichsarbeitsdienst, yes. And I stayed there until I was called up in 41, on the 1st of June, 41. Because everybody had to do the national service either in the Luftwaffe, or in the, which is the Air Force, or in the Army, or in the Navy, Kriegsmarine. And I was called up in the Kriegsmarine, and when I was called up to Husum, which is in Schleswig-Holstein, and I must tell you, when I was called up there, we were asked to volunteer for, we were asked to volunteer for U-boats. And I was daft enough to volunteer, but my left eardrum is pierced. This was an accident at school while swimming. So I couldn't stand the pressure, and I wasn't fit for U-boat service. Again, it was a blessing in disguise. In fact, I've had many very close shaves when disaster could have struck.
Did you want to go into the Navy?
Not particularly, no, no. But on the other hand, I thought it was better than the Army. No.
Where did you get your naval training?
At Husum, in Schleswig-Holstein. And there it is, you got the... It was the second... It was the third company, Ersatz Marine Artillery Regiment, and let's see, it was the second Admiral of the North Sea, I believe. It came under the second Admiral of the North Sea.
What did the naval training consist of?
Well, this was marine artillery, heavy artillery. First, we had our ordinary training, which everybody got, for about 6-8 weeks. With guns and square bashing and things like that. And then we had were sent to the different batteries. But I was sent to Wimmera with two or three others with the recommendation to go to an anti-aircraft school, which was at Mimisan Plage in southern France. In fact, you might have heard of Mimisan Plage. Churchill had a lovely country house there.
I've been there.
You have it? Oh, well, that's, I will show you some photographs presently of this anti-aircraft school. And there we were taught how to use light anti-aircraft guns by using the guns, an old Junkers 88, one of the old planes, with the corrugated iron, used to fly up and down across the seashore with a great big trailing, a great big balloon, like a great big sausage. And we were practicing our skills on this sausage. And of course, every hit you could see, because there was a little flash when you hit through this silk or whatever this thing was made of. And every hit was recorded. And from there, I was sent back to Wimmera after I had been there for about 4 months and given an anti-aircraft gun.
Well, let's go back to the earlier part in 1941. What did you feel about the quality of the training that you had in Husum?
In Husum? I thought it was quite good. It was not too bad, not as bad as I expected it. In fact, I thought it was rather better than the Arbeitsdienst. In the Arbeitsdienst, the first 6 weeks were harder than at Husum.
What was discipline like in the German Navy?
Quite good. But also, on the other hand, after about 4 weeks, they let us out of barracks, whereas in the Arbeitsdienst, the first leave we had was about, after two months, I believe, or 10 or 12 weeks. And the people in Husum, the locals, were quite friendly. In fact, I had a girlfriend in Husum at the time. So Husum is... I have happy memories of Husum.
But your first posting at Wimmera was on the heavy guns.
That was... No. That's the... I was posted for the anti-aircraft guns. That's why they sent me to this school. I never became a member of the crews for the heavy guns. Our anti-aircraft guns were there to protect the heavy battery from low-flying planes, which we did right to the end. Although in 1944, of course, when the Canadians came and overran Boulogne and Calais had already fallen, we were bombarded by planes for several days, continuous bombing.
That's jumping ahead a bit, but yes. Just let's go back to the early days. Did you get many raids in the early days on these gun sites that you were protecting?
Not too many, no, but quite often we used to get low-flying planes who had been in dogfights, especially in 1940, the Battle of Britain. You know, I must tell you that at Cap Grenet, the Luftwaffe was stationed. And you must have heard of Adolf Galland. Well, he was stationed there. In fact, I met him on one or two occasions. Cap Grenet was quite close to our battery. And, of course, his boys, they used to be engaged in dogfights over the channel. Very often, a plane, either a Messerschmitt or a Spitfire or a Hurricane, came quite low over our battery. And on one occasion, I remember, by mistake, we actually fired on a Messerschmitt, one of our own planes, and were, of course, rebuked for it. But then, if a plane is very low and it comes so quickly, you cannot see which it is, although we could distinguish which was a Spitfire and which was a Hurricane. The Spitfire was A, distinguishable by the oval wings, and under the right wing there was a great big square box. So even if it came head on to you, you knew it was a Spitfire. Whereas the Messerschmitt had two boxes, smaller ones, one under each wing. So just on one occasion, mind you, we didn't do any damage. But we did bring two Spitfires down, which had already been winged. And I don't know how true it is, but when Douglas Bader was shot down, his plane came over us, and he flew inland, and then he had to bail out. Perhaps you know about this. And then, of course, Adolf Galland was there when he climbed out of the plane, and he couldn't believe his eyes when the chappie told him he had no legs. And then afterwards, after they had treated him to a meal at the officer's mess and showed him the latest plane, he wanted to know whether he could climb in, but they declined the offer. I don't know whether you know, but one of the artificial legs of Bader was then dropped by special concession by Hermann Göring.
Yes, I did.
A marked plane came over and sent it down by parachute from England to replace his legs.
Can you tell me about what you remember of the famous channel breakout of the Scharnhorst?
I do, yes, because it was a filthy day. It was foggy and it was raining. And we were only told about an hour or two before. We had no idea. It was all very, very hush-hush that we could expect low-flying planes. And then we heard, of course, the gunfire from our side and probably from England as well. And then suddenly, out of the mist, we saw these two big cruisers and the Prince Eugen appearing and going by. And it was then that we downed two swordfish.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I thought they were so terribly slow. They were really sitting ducks in comparison to a Spitfire. It was a suicide mission. These poor chaps, they probably had one torpedo or whatever they had underneath, and they tried to drop that and sink those battleships. It was out of the question. They had no chance, I feel. None whatsoever. And I believe the Air Force encountered very... Although it was the sea air arm, wasn't it, mostly, the planes, I understand.
Fleet air arm.
They must have had very, very heavy losses. Very heavy losses, indeed.
Were these two swordfish over the sea when you shot them down?
Yes, and coming in, that's right.
Coming into what?
Into France. Coming into Wimereux, from the sea. They obviously probably tried to dodge the heavy flak from the battleships, because they had 8.8 flak on the battleships, whereas ours were only 20 millimeters, the old Oerlikons. They came in and probably, who knows, they might have already been winged. Anyway, they came down. And we were credited with two of them.
Did you see anybody bail out?
Yeah. And one of them couldn't, apparently. And he stayed in the plane and unfortunately was killed and probably burned to death.
What was your job on the Oerlikon?
I was in charge of the Oerlikon. I was the Geschützführer. I had to train them. And then afterwards, when the Canadians came, but that's later, we had five anti-aircraft guns. Three had already fallen out through heavy bombings, and the last two I blew up. But I've come to that back later on, if you like.
Any other memories about the channel breakout?
We knew that next day they had arrived at Kiel safely. We were told they had pushed through, and of course it was a big propaganda feed for Hitler. There, you see, two heavy ships right under the nose of the British had passed through without a scuff. In fact, had shot down, I don't know, dozens of planes. And in spite of the heavy bombardment from Britain, they had made it without any loss, I believe. Not a single person. There might have been one or two wounded, I don't know. But we were told it was done with no loss of life.
Did you get incoming fire from Dover area onto your positions at Wimereux?
We did. We did in September. In fact, we had one full hit straight into the opening of the gun. And this opening was protected by very heavy chains. And because our observation post, from where the heavy guns were directed to shoot across the channel to Dover or to Folkestone, had already fallen out through the bombing. One of the MR Marts, which was a sergeant, was lying on these heavy guns directing the fire, lying on the barrel itself. And he got killed by this direct hit. Although the protection wasn't good enough. These very heavy chains wasn't good enough, because probably the shrapnel or whatever it was, the poor chap got killed. What I found most interesting is this book by Sir Brian Horrocks, whom I met, by the way, in 1951. He was a guest speaker at the Chamber of Commerce dinner dance. He came to us, and I was introduced to him, and we talked about this. At that time, he was Black Ross in Parliament. That was his post. Anyway, later on, if you read, I marked these things. If you read that, that's his memories. He speaks of a direct hit of one of the batteries, and I believe it is possible that he means our battery Friedrich August, although he doesn't mention the battery. There were about five or six very heavy batteries in Pas-de-Calais. Our battery was battery Friedrich August.
And you say it was September?
That was in September, yes.
1944.
You know, Boulogne had already fallen. I believe Boulogne fell September. I've marked it down. Hang on. Somewhere here. So, Boulogne had fallen, or the Battle of Boulogne had started September the 17th. And I believe it took them 4 days to capture Boulogne. Our battery capitulated on the 23rd of September, after Boulogne had fallen and the day before Calais had already fallen. We were completely surrounded by the Canadians. Now, such was the mood amongst the soldiers in the heavy battery that it was useless to continue. And the officers were actually threatened by our men to capitulate, otherwise they would probably revolt and shoot the officers and the NCOs. So with tears in his eyes, the old man gave the order to hoist the white flag.
So his men forced him to?
More or less, yes. And I was told I would be shot because I continued using the last gun which I had to shoot across the lines where the Canadians had already dug in on the other side, which on reflection of course was stupid, although at the time I didn't think it was stupid. I thought I did my duty right to the end.
Who threatened you?
People of our own guns, because they were already, in fact, they knew the war was lost. Anybody with any sense really knew the war was lost. But then we had always been told about these secret weapons, the V1 and 2. And of course some of us probably thought, well, that he might still pull it off. But such was the mood that if the commander of the battery hadn't given the order, I'm sure we would have had a mutiny on our hands.
Where did these men come from? All from Germany?
They came mostly from northern Germany, some from the world, yes.
So they weren't Volksdeutsche?
No, they were no. Whereas on the other hand, I must tell you that in Dunkirk, for example, they held out right to the end of the war. Mind you, the Allies didn't bother, because they didn't have to bother anymore. You see, Antwerp had fallen in the end, and they had